Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland. I'm your host Fraser, and I'm thrilled to embark on another historical journey with all of you. In our previous episodes, we retraced the footsteps of a king who was indelibly etched in his legacy deep within the annals of the Scottish rich tapestry, David I. A colossus in Scottish history, David's rule was a whirlwind of war, transformative revolutions, and momentous changes that have undeniably marked the course of Scotland's destiny. Though I'm deeply connected to the tales of his era, after nearly six captivating episodes, it's time to turn the pages and dive deeper into other facets of our fascinating past. Today, we're taking a bit of a detour. Instead of discussing the reign of our next king, Malcolm IV, we're transporting ourselves into the shoes of an average Scot in the 12th century. Have you ever wondered how they started their day? What kind of food graced their tables, or the kind of homes they lived in? Ever pondered about the contrasts in the lives of the nobility and clergy? Well, wonder no more. Today we'll explore the rhythms, routines and realities of daily life in the 12th century Scotland, providing a holistic view of a world that once was. So, dear listeners, are you ready for this refreshing change of pace? Let's venture together into the everyday life of an average Scottish man or woman in the 12th century. As always, pour yourself a nice hot drink, get comfy if you're sitting down, turn the speakers or radio up, and let's delve right in. Alright, let's dive into the subject that, while perhaps is not the most thrilling, has been the lifeblood of civilizations and societies for eons: the economy. The intricate web of trade, currency and commerce. While often overlooked in favour of tales of valiant knights and imposing castles, the economy provides a unique lens through which we can truly understand the nuts and bolts of a society. In the 12th century, Scotland's economy was undergoing significant transformation. To begin with, let's address the coin of the realm. By this time, Scotland had indeed embraced the concept of minted coins. In 12th century Scotland, well, especially under the reign of David I, he started to truly develop its own distinctive monetary system. Before David's reforms, Scotland largely relied on a system of barter or used foreign coins, especially Anglo-Saxon coins, for trade and other financial transactions. However, David's extended stay in England, his familiarity with the Norman practices, and his desire to modernise and strengthen Scotland's economic foundations spurred significant change in this regard. David introduced silver pennies, which were quite similar to the pennies circulating in England. These pennies bore his image and title, asserting both his royal authority and the sovereignty of Scotland. They were minted in various locations, including Edinburgh, Carlisle and Roxburgh. The process of coin minting not only indicated the economic aspirations of David, but also showcased his determination to create a centralised authority, a hallmark of a modern state. The use of silver pennies was consistent with the broader European trends at the time. The European monetary system, especially after the collapse of the Carolingian Empire, started shifting towards a silver standard, with the silver penny becoming a widespread currency. These coins weren't just symbolic tokens of royalty, they played a practical role in daily transactions and facilitated trade, both internally and with neighbouring regions. As commerce expanded and towns grew, the need for a standardised currency became all the more essential. David's coins helped in fulfilling this need, thus ushering in a new era of economic prosperity for Scotland. But the method of tax collection under kings like David exhibited commitment to modernisation of the further Scottish economy. Again, he took cues from the Norman English system and integrated some of its advanced systems into Scotland's administrative structure. With the import of feudalism into Scotland, David formalised the relationship between the crown and the nobles, like we told in the last few episodes. Lords were required to provide the king with military service or its equivalent in money, known as a scutage. In exchange, they were granted lands. This exchange and system made it easier to call upon resources in times of war, but also provided a steady stream of revenue to the crown. David I's charter reforms led to the establishment of many new boroughs, like we know. These were essentially market towns with certain privileges. Residents of these boroughs, known as burgesses, held their property for a tenure called a bugage. They paid an annual fee or rent directly to the king or landlord. This consistent source of income further cemented the royal coffers. Trade blossomed under David's reign, especially in the new chartered boroughs. The king imposed customs duties on goods that were imported or exported, and tolls were collected from merchants passing through various checkpoints or using certain roads and bridges. The church was another significant source of revenue. David's ecclesiastical reforms and the establishment of new monastic institutions meant that large tracts of land came under the church. A tithe, typically one-tenth of the produce, was expected from these lands, which, although primarily for the church, often benefited the crown indirectly given the close relationship between the Scottish church and the monarchy. The judiciary and legal reforms also inherited by David played a role in revenue collection. Fines were levied on those who breached the law, and they were fees associated with legal processes, land transfers, and the like. The economy of Scotland in the 12th century was a time of immense change and growth, and central to this economic story was our, unfortunately, dead and past king, King David I. A monarch whose impact on the trade can hardly be overstated. Under his guidance, Scotland's commercial heartbeat quickened. One of the driving focuses of our nation's economy during this period was also wool. Picture this: across the rolling Scottish highlands and lowlands, vast stretches of land covered in flocks of sheep. These weren't just any sheep, they bore the wool that would become Scotland's ticket to burgeoning European markets. This wool, prized for its quality, would be sheared, bundled and sent off, often in its raw form, to weavers, clothers across the continent. But it wasn't just about wool. Our land and waters were bountiful. There was fish, particularly herring, which were caught in cold, pristine waters surrounding Scotland. These would find their way to tables not just in Scotland or England, but far beyond, even reaching the warm Mediterranean coasts. Now, where did our exports go, you wonder? While England was undeniably a significant trade partner, Scotland was by no means insular. By the 12th century, we'd already cast our trade nets wide. The docks of Scotland saw ships embarking on voyages to places like Flanders, in modern-day Belgium, a major hub for European trade. Our merchants also ventured to northern France, trading Scottish goods for fine wines and other continental luxuries. Norse territories like Iceland and the Faroe Islands became frequent ports of call. And of course, let's not forget our Celtic neighbours, Ireland, with whom we had long-standing ties. European trade? Oh, it was very much alive and bustling. The European connection was not just about commerce. It was a two-way street. While we exported our natural resources, we imported a variety of products, including fine textiles, spices, and wine, integrating Scotland into the broader European economic and cultural narrative. But remember, trade wasn't just about products, it was about people. Scottish merchants, sailors, and traders crisscrossing the known world brought back with them stories, experiences, and the ideas that would shape Scotland we know today. Every bale of wool, every barrel of fish wasn't just a commodity, it was a testament to Scotland's ever-evolving relationship with the world. The range of professions available to the Scots in the 12th century was vast, but not all jobs were created in equal terms of compensation and prestige. Just as now, your job could easily vastly affect your lifestyle and social status, even if you weren't of noble birth. On one end of the spectrum, you had the skilled craftsmen. Stonemasons, for instance, were highly sought after, especially during this period of rapid infrastructural development. As towns expanded and churches, cathedrals, and castles sprouted across the landscape, a skilled mason could command a decent wage. Similarly, merchants, particularly those involved in international trade, could accumulate substantial wealth, even rivaling some nobles in terms of affluence. Contrast this with the life of a farm labourer or a fisherman. These individuals often lived on a subsistence wage, working long hours with few guarantees. Their income was not just low, it was also unstable, vulnerable to factors like weather conditions, crop yields, and market fluctuations. A poor harvest season could spell disaster for a farm worker and their family. And let's be honest, there was more labourers and fishermen than there was merchants and stonemasons. So you can understand how a poor harvest would have a massive effect across the Scottish people and how that would sometimes result in rebellions and petitions to the royal families. Now let's talk about the elephant in the room, the wars with England. Now, we've already discussed the war with England with David I, where he lost at the Battle of the Standard, but let's discuss what type of impact that had on the economy. Conflict, as you can imagine, is rarely a good thing for the economy, and Scotland was no exception. The costs were multifaceted. On the most basic level, warfare required funds. This meant higher taxes and levies draining resources of both nobles and commoners. Agricultural productivity suffered as fields were trampled by marching armies or left unattended when men were called to fight. Trade routes were disrupted and Scottish merchants often found themselves at risk of plunder both on land and at sea. Moreover, English invasions often targeted Scotland's economic hubs, looting towns and destroying infrastructure. Think of Berwick in the last episode. Rebuilding these places took time and resources, further straining the economy. But it wasn't all bleak. The constant need for arms and armaments did bolster some industries. Blacksmiths, armourers and bowers, for example, saw a surge in demand for their expertise. Yet on balance, the English wars were a significant drain on the Scottish economy. The uncertainties of conflict discouraged long-term investment and made foreign merchants wary of trading with Scotland. It's a testament to the resilience of the Scottish people that, in between periods of conflict, they managed to rebuild, trade and innovate, laying the foundation for the nation's future economic successes. Now, let's step back to a time when life's peace was decidedly different, but no less full. Picture yourself in a small village, surrounded by the rolling green highlands of 12th century Scotland. The life of an average low-born Scot was markedly different from our modern existence, influenced by the seasons, the land, and the overarching presence of the church. At the start of the day, the rooster's crow that aged the old alarm clock signalled the start of the day, usually coinciding with the first of the sun's light, around 5 or 6 a.m. The low-born Scot didn't have the luxury of lounging. The day's task beckoned. So, what did he have for breakfast? Morning meals were modest, usually comprising of oat cakes, a staple of the Scottish diet, made from oats that were grounded, mixed with some water and baked on a griddle. A touch of butter or cheese might be added for flavour. The beverage of choice, you ask? It wasn't water, it was ale. While it might be a surprise of our modern sensibilities, ale was commonly consumed even at breakfast. It was weaker than what we're accustomed to and considered safer than water, which could be contaminated. By the time the sun was fully up, work was well underway. Agriculture was a mainstay for many Scots, and the work was grueling. With rudimentary tools, fields were ploughed and crops sown, primarily barley and oats. Livestock, especially sheep and cattle, required tending. The wool industry, driven by the sheep farms, was starting to burgeon during this period, becoming an important economic driver by the end of the century, like I've just mentioned earlier on. Homes of the lowborn were functional rather than grand. Constructed from wattle and dub from with thatched roofs, it provided the bare necessities. Space was limited, yet it wasn't uncommon for these single-room dwellings to house extended family members. This combination fostered a strong sense of community and kinship. Now, speaking of community, there was a time for community. As the day waned, families congregated for their main meal. Stews or broths, thick with vegetables and enhanced with available meats or fish, were standard fare. Bread was a staple, usually made from barley or oats. These meals, eaten together around the communal hearth, were as much about bonding and sharing stories as they were about sustenance. Also, if you were lucky enough to go to a lord's land, you'd be greeted with a grand feast of greater meats, greater fruits, maybe spices, maybe even meats you've never met, potatoes. So there was gigantic resource in these meals. So, if you were lucky enough to go to a noble's castle or land and you were invited to a great feast, you would eat as much as you can, but you would do so knowing that you can't really have this type of meal all the time. So you really, really indulged your taste buds, let's say. Think of Christmas when you go home in today's age. When I go home, I have a massive Christmas dinner and I fill myself to the brim. I never normally eat as much than I do at Christmas. That's kind of similar to the grand feasts that were held at noble castles and lands. The omnipresent church played a crucial role in the daily life as well. Villagers regularly attended Mass, and the rhythm of life was punctuated by the numerous saint days and religious festivals. In 1124, when David began his reign, there was a marked increase in religious establishments, leading to the rise of the monastic communities in Scotland. These institutions became hubs for learning, culture, and sometimes even for commerce. When rare moments of free time emerged, the Scots knew how to make the most of it. Storytelling was a favourite pastime. Tales of valour, legends and myths passed down through the generations in the many inns and taverns throughout the Scottish towns and cities. Music, dancing and games also played a significant role. The Celtic harp, pipes and drums provided the soundtrack to many an evening. You could imagine heading to the tavern or inn on your day off on a Sunday or in the evening, getting yourself some drink such as ale, getting yourself some meat or stew, sitting down at a table of friends or family, listening to the many stories and legends of, you know, the European continent or the Faroe Islands or the Norse legends of their invaders of Scotland, hearing about it, all the families and people inside the inn and tavern crowded round storytellers with a roaring fire, a stew that definitely was there for a few days has been brewing away, and you can get yourself a few scoops and then drink as much ale and pass out from the drunkenness if you wish. The inns and taverns were a crucial part of medieval society. It was a place for social communities to fester. It was a place to talk. It was a place to even meet fellow friends and your future wife if need be. After a long day though, and if you weren't as passed out as the many ale drinkers in the inn or tavern, by the time darkness enveloped the village, it was time for rest. But before sleep, there might be a moment for reflection or prayer, a nod to the deep-rooted faith that underscored their lives. The life of a lowborn Scot in the 12th century was one of hard work, community, and a deep connection to the land and faith. While far removed from our own contemporary experiences, it offers a fascinating glimpse into a world where simple pleasures, family and faith took centre stage. In the tapestry of 12th century Scotland, the vibrant threads of religious fervour cannot be ignored. While the medieval world was fundamentally intertwined with faith, Scotland experienced its own unique spiritual journey during this period. Brought to the forefront by the significant reforms and influence of St. Margaret of Scotland and King David I, often hailed as the saintly king, David's tenure bore witness to a remarkable religious metamorphosis in Scotland. During this time, the religious aura of Scotland resonated deeply with the serene chants emanating from the monastic houses. One of the most transformative introductions was the Cistercian Order. Their presence, which was established with the founding of the illustrious Melrose Abbey, which would in time become a beacon of spirituality and a hub of monastic life. And with these monastic orders came a new rhythm of devout life marked by discipline, prayer and labour. But how would an aspirant enter into such a devout life? As with most monastic traditions, a life dedicated to God began with a calling, a divine inspiration or a personal desire to serve God. An individual would start as a novice, undergoing rigorous spiritual training before taking their solemn vows and fully immersing themselves in the monastic lifestyle. Living as a clergyman in this era was by no means a tranquil retreat from the world. It was in fact a life brimming with responsibilities and commitments. Daily life was reimagined, with canonical hours dictating the rhythm of prayers, readings and labour. A typical day would commence with lauds at dawn, followed by a series of prayers throughout the day, circulating in the evening with vespers and compline. The ecclesiastical hierarchy of Scotland, much like other parts of Christendom, was well defined. At the zenith stood the bishops, who wielded both spiritual and temporal power. Underneath them were the priests, responsible for the parishes and the spiritual needs of the laity. The monastic communities, while holding significant influence, often operated autonomously, guided by their abbots. Yet this intricate web of religious hierarchy was not without its tensions. As the Church of Scotland sought to consolidate its power and autonomy, clashes with the nobility and even with the crown were inevitable. The assertion of the papal authority and the rights and privileges of the church often found itself at odds with the interests of Scottish nobles and kings. This tussle for power and influence between the divine and the mortal became a recurring theme, defining the relationship between clergy and the Scottish court. The sanctity of the church juxtaposed the ambitions of the nobility. It also made for an intricate dance of power. In short, Christianity was alive and well in Scotland. It affected every common man, woman, and child, but also affected the nobility and the kings of Scotland. The Christian church would continue to grow under the future kings of Scotland, and only further enhance its influence over the many common people, men and women alike. In the rolling hills and vast landscapes of 12th century Scotland, the silhouette of castles and armoured men on horseback painted a vivid picture of a society evolving under feudal influences. The nobility and knighthood were foundational pillars of this transformation. Becoming a noble during this period was typically rooted in birthright. Families of noble lineage held lands and titles passed down through generations. While nobility primarily ran through blood, it wasn't exclusively inherited. Service to the crown, particularly military and administrative, could sometimes earn a man noble status. Land, titles, and the responsibility that came with them could be granted by the king as rewards for loyalty and service. Think of all the Norman noble lords that we touched in the last episodes, where King David imported quite a few noble lords, Norman lords, into the lands of Scotland. Yet, while influence and wealth could pave avenues of power, buying one's way directly into nobility wasn't as straightforward. A merchant could amass significant wealth, but they couldn't outright purchase a title. Knighthood in Scotland, while influenced by the chivalric traditions of continental Europe, retained its distinctive flavour. By the 12th century, the concept of a mounted warrior or knight was well entrenched. A young man aspiring to knighthood would start as a page, moving on to squire status in his teenage years. After proving himself often on the battlefield in tournaments, he'd undergo the ceremonial accolade, where a lord or knight would dub him, often with the flat of a sword, marking his entry into knighthood. These knights and nobles didn't exist in a vacuum. Their influence permeated throughout society. As landlords, they had direct impact on the peasantry, set in terms of tenancy, rents, and duties. Their patronage could also be influential with the religious circles, with some nobles acting as benefactors for the monasteries or churches. Meanwhile, the knighthood often provided military services to the nobility, further intertwining their fates. In terms of hierarchy in the social structure, it was quite clearly defined. You had the king, whose sovereignty was the law. The high nobles, these were the earls and other high-ranking lords with vast lands and significant influence. The lesser nobles, who were barons and laylords who held smaller territories but still played pivotal roles within their localities. Knights, who were warriors of the realm, often holding lands themselves and providing military service in exchange. Freed tenants, who were landholders who paid their dues to nobles and knights. Clergy, their influence spanned both spiritual and temporal realms, and while some church officials like bishops wielded power comparable to nobles, others, like parish priests, lived humbler lives. And then finally, you had the commoners. The vast group of consisted craftsmen, merchants, and peasants, with peasants often living as tenants on lands owned by the nobility. This mosaic of societal roles made the medieval Scottish realm a complex web of interdependencies where power dynamics were constantly in flux, shaped by politics, war, faith, and ambition. Now, let's end today's episode by acknowledging the wealth of resources that provided the backbone to our deep dive today. The detailed intricacies of the 12th century Scotland would remain elusive if it weren't for the tireless work of many historians and their contributions. Now, I know I don't normally do this a lot and point to our sources at the end of episodes, but with the extra time we can fill today, I did want to point out some material. Key among them are The Kingdom of the Scots by J.W.S. Barrow, Medieval Scotland, Crown, Lordship and Community by Alexander Grant and Keith Stringer, and the writings from the Chronicle of Melrose, which provided pivotal first-hand accounts of the period. The rich tapestry of Scotland's history isn't woven overnight, and these texts, among several others, have been instrumental. Now, drawing our attention back to today's narrative, hasn't it been truly enlightening? The vivid imagery of a typical day in the life of a 12th century Scot, their trials, their celebrations, their faith, and their social structures. It's been a whirlwind of information. I genuinely hope you've enjoyed this time travel as much as I have. And a moment of mild amusement here. For the first time in a while, we haven't stretched our discourse to the 30-minute mark. Quite the achievement, I'd say. Perhaps we're on to a new trend. Only time will tell, though. Looking ahead, our upcoming episodes promise to be just as enthralling. We'll delve into Scotland's role on the European broader stage, demonstrating how this proud nation engaged with its continental neighbours. Following that, sharpen your blades and ready your shields as we explore the military tactics of 12th century and 13th century Scotland. By the end of November, as the leaves turn and winter beckons, we'll be ready to embark on a new journey with David's grandson and the next King of Scotland, Malcolm IV. A gentle reminder to all of our dedicated listeners, our episodes are out weekly, so mark your calendars for our next release. If you enjoy our content, which I hope you do, please consider following us on Twitter at TheHistoryOfSE1. That is, at TheHistoryOfSE1. We also have a Facebook page called The History of Scotland Podcast. Our interactions, reviews and feedback give us lots of information to continue our work. So please leave a review on your preferred podcasting platform if you can. Thank you for all the recent reviews and to all the new people that have joined our Facebook page as well. For those on the move or in the need of historical immersion during your daily routines, remember our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean and many other great podcasting sites. All that is left is to say thank you for being with us today. Dive deep into history, cherish the moments, and more importantly, keep that curiosity alive. Have a fabulous week, guys. Enjoy the week ahead. And until next time, stay safe and goodbye. Peace.